Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. Today's program is another in my Health Challenges series. My guest is Scott Creery. Creery is a graduate of Cornell University, where he received his bachelor's in horticulture, and the University of Maryland at College Park, where he received his master's in entomology. He has worked through the years as an entomologist, a biocontrol consultant, and a beekeeper. He is currently pursuing an independent consulting and beekeeping business. Creery was diagnosed with a human immunodeficiency virus known as HIV in 2008 during a medical exam. We'll talk about his journey coping with this incurable virus that can sometimes lead to AIDS. And welcome to the show.
Hi there.
Nice to have you here. Now tell me, you were diagnosed with HIV in 2008, as I understand it, when you were in grad school in Maryland.
Yep.
What was happening? Was this totally out of the blue? Had you had any symptoms, or was this unexpected?
No, I didn't have any symptoms, none of the typical seroconversion signs, which would be like a very severe flu and all that. But yeah, none of that happened. So I was just, you know, went in for screening and there you go. You get called into the little room and then you just, you know that, you know it's not good.
So this was a screening where they actually drew blood. It wasn't like they were just checking your heart, your blood pressure.
Right, yeah.
And what were they looking for by drawing blood? Just to, because usually they have to zone in, I understand.
Yeah, so this was actually screening for Peace Corps. So they had to do kind of a battery of different tests to make sure that you were properly immunized for anything that might come up in sub-Saharan Africa. So it was a little bit more rigorous than just, you know, I have a cough today.
Yeah. So tell us what happened. How did they tell you this?
Well, the stereotype is kind of held true in my instance. They're like, oh, well, we need to talk. You know, you get the phone call and then you get pulled into the room and it's you know something not good is going to come up.
Yeah.
So then, you know, sit down and we've got bad news for you. So, you know, the test came back and it seems like you have tested positive for HIV, and then they do a Western blot test, which is a little bit more definitive than the typical antibody test, which is cheap and easy. And that came back positive as well. So.
Oh, my God. But they caught it before you had any symptoms, which is a good thing, right? I mean,
well, so often with HIV, you just don't have symptoms for several years because it takes a while, and it's a chronic inflammatory illness. But the whole your immune system becoming decrepit and everything, that takes many years to develop in some cases.
Yeah. So what did you do? How did you deal with this? Did you tell your family? Did you have close friends you could confide in?
I was dating someone at the time, so that was very helpful. And he was a nurse practitioner, which was even more helpful because I don't think I would have had the presence of mind to, like, get my butt into medical care and that sort of thing. So he was very instrumental in getting me out of kind of self-pity.
And did he immediately have to get tested too to make sure he wasn't positive?
Right.
Wow. Did they still do that thing that they did in the early days of AIDS when I lived in San Francisco? You have to try to figure out who you'd been with and tell everybody that they might have been exposed. Do they still do that?
Well, I think the approach is a little bit more nuanced now. So they do try to get that information out of you, and then they go about and make the calls themselves. But with the age of the internet, oftentimes, you know, you just don't have names. So it becomes very difficult to track down individuals. But, you know, because it's a reportable illness, just like any other sexually transmitted infection, they do try to find people that might be at risk.
Wow. Oh, this is still a scary disease. Now, you say that, thank God you had a nurse practitioner, a boyfriend at the time, because were you in denial? Did you not want to seek treatment? What was the next step?
Well, depression. So nothing ever happens in a vacuum.
Yeah.
Lots of other aspects in life were kind of heading downhill at that particular moment in time. So it was just icing on the cake, and I just didn't want to. It wasn't so much denial. It was just the options just seemed very bleak because you're looking at kind of a chemically dependent life.
Absolutely.
After that.
Absolutely, yep.
And I didn't necessarily want to face that reality.
But you had to, right?
Right. The other option is just to give up. But, you know, I didn't go into treatment right away, which is kind of contrary to what would happen today. They want to push people into treatment as early as possible.
Yeah.
But it took me, I don't know, maybe 5 years from that point to get my head around the idea of taking medication.
Yeah, I can understand that. I mean, you're looking at something that's a lifetime commitment, at least at this point, mm-hmm. because we haven't got a cure. Well, talk to us about the drugs that you ended up getting on. Is it still called the cocktail? Is the regimen still is difficult to follow?
So in days long ago, it was a cocktail and be at a party and everyone's watches would just keep going off because they'd be like, it would be reminding them to take another pill because often it would be like four times a day you had to take, you know, X, Y, or Z different medication because they all were independent of one another. Whereas now it's actually much simpler and much more user-friendly and many of the newer medications are a once-a-day thing.
Really?
Which are in themselves a cocktail of different antiretrovirals. I don't know if I could have adhered to something so regimented as...
Oh, I can imagine. You know, even people who are meticulous, sometimes you forget.
Right, yeah. And then you have those scary moments like, oh, crap, I forgot my pill. And then, yeah, like when my mom was dying, I was in Ohio. I didn't have any access to medications. I was calling my doctor and they're like, well, we can't really get it to you. So
oh, my God.
Not adhering to the regimen, of course, is...
Really?
A very risky business.
I'm sure it must be. So what is the regimen? You get up in the morning and you take a pill? Is it still a thing where this one you have to take with food, this one has to be on an empty stomach?
Yeah. So the first one that I went on is called Atripla, which was the first of the one-a-day deals. That one they told you to take at night because it makes your head really loopy. So like dizziness, kind of fogginess, and so on. So for like the first 2 weeks I was on it, I was like breaking out in hives. I had these crazy dreams, which never really went away. But so I wasn't sleeping and I couldn't really interact with people because it was so foggy.
Wow.
I remember being at a Dunkin' Donuts just trying to order some breakfast and I was just staring blankly at the board being like, I know this should make sense to me, but I can't really do it right now.
Oh, so people probably thought you were stoned.
Yeah.
I mean, I know there are side effects to almost any drug and these mm-hmm. drugs, certainly they're powerful.
Yeah.
But how long did that side effect problem and the fogginess
last? So the fogginess was for about 2 weeks and the rash was for about 2 weeks and there's not really anything to be done about it. Your body's just kind of reacting to very, very heavy doses of chemicals coursing through your blood.
But you get used to it, huh?
You get used to it, and the fogginess does go away. So now I'm on a different medication called Stribild, which has just been wonderful, because with the Atripla, you do need to take it at a very specific time, and if you deviate by even like 2 hours, all that spinniness and weirdness comes back.
Oh, God.
And the dreams, I would go months without sleeping because you would have these like crazy, crazy dreams, which were actually, you know, kind of psychedelic and fun in retrospect. But, you know, I just wasn't sleeping. So,
God, that sounds awful because you do need to sleep. Tell us what else you need to do when you're diagnosed with HIV. Do you have to go on a good diet? Do they tell you, you know, all the healthy things that one needs to do? Do you have to stop partying and drinking?
Yeah. I mean, all of it is common sense to a certain extent. They didn't really do a whole lot of preaching because I think in many instances they're used to dealing with a wide variety of people. And so I think that's one of the things that people who study infectious diseases kind of have come to the realization that it is a very broad swath of the population and you're going to have like the recreational drug users and they're going to be going through the same standard of care as people who take better care of themselves and mm-hmm. try to do the right thing. You know, I did my own homework and the leading cause of death among people with HIV is just liver failure.
That's you're putting chemicals in your body. You're screwing with your organs. I know.
Yeah.
Especially the organ that's supposed to filter through all the toxins.
Right. So you go on a bender every so often and it's like, well, you're taking a few days off your life, but hopefully it's from the crappy end.
Now, let's talk about the fact that HIV is it's not necessarily a step toward AIDS, but mm-hmm. it couldn't be a precursor. Have you ever fallen into full-blown AIDS and gotten pneumonia or, you know, any of those TB, all those horrible things that people with AIDS can actually get?
I don't really know the standard as it exists in America today, but it seems to me, at least, that AIDS exists primarily in people who just don't enter into care at all.
Yeah.
So that would be kind of the forgotten folks, recreational drug users particularly, where you don't think to get checked and things rapidly spiral out of control. And so once your white cell counts reach a certain point, they're like, okay, well, we really need to start thinking about getting you on antiretrovirals because this is going to get to a point. And AIDS itself is really just kind of, it's an academic threshold. So once your cell counts are at a certain point, it's like, okay, well, you've graduated into AIDS.
Yeah, yeah.
Which doesn't...
That's the T cell count that became so famous during the time when we were trying to figure out what this was.
Yeah. But it doesn't necessarily hold any water in terms of your overall health.
Yeah, yeah. You know. I think a lot of people in the public don't know the difference between HIV and AIDS, and that's why I wanted to make it clear. HIV is an infection with a virus, and AIDS
right.
is the full-blown repercussions that can happen from that if you don't take your drugs and take care of yourself.
So AIDS is more of a symptom, and HIV would be the cause.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
AIDS is actually a battery of symptoms.
Yeah, yeah.
But from a medical standpoint, it's basically when your cell counts are at a certain point.
Yeah. Well, what did this do to you psychologically? Did it change your life entirely? Are you always on alert and feeling anxiety going, oh, my God, is this the beginning of AIDS? Is this the flu?
Yeah.
You know?
Well, and it exists in your brain on some largely irrational sphere. But it's something that comes to the fore. It's like, oh, God, I've got a really nasty cold, like, what does this mean? And I missed a dose of my pill, so it might have like a resistant strain and that sort of thing. So you get into that, I guess, and it does certainly bear on one's mind every so often.
Mm-hmm. It hasn't taken over your whole life.
No.
Have you figured out ways to cope? I mean, I talked to somebody with cancer, and she says exercise helped her, meditation, yoga, that kind of thing. Have you tried to do any of those kinds of things to calm your mind, so to speak?
Well, I do like to exercise. So recently, I've been doing it a little bit more frequently. But in the summer months, there's never really a problem because, you know, I just have so much work to do that I don't have time to think about things. And in the winter is when I become pensive, but, you know, I don't really have the discipline to really do a lot of, like, meditation and clearing.
Well, it sounds like you probably don't need to if you're doing okay psychologically and you know, it's not taking over your life and making you into a totally anxiety-ridden human being.
Well,
right?
You know, you have your ups and downs.
Oh, yeah.
And you get in the gutter and you hope that you have kind of that oomph to get yourself out. Or, you know, friends or support systems and so on.
I was going to ask you about that, too. Support systems. Did your family support you? Did you tell them immediately?
My sister and my brother-in-law. But, you know, I didn't tell anyone for several years after just because it was a private matter and it just didn't seem like anyone really needed to know. And, you know, my family has their own issues, so I didn't really want to burden them.
Uh-huh. If you're just joining us, my guest is Scott Creery. I'm talking to him. This is another in my Health Challenges series about his diagnosis and living with HIV. Let's talk about the stigma. I mean, you brought this up when I first booked you. I am surprised that there's still such a stigma, although I shouldn't be. But obviously, it's become a subject that's talked about openly, opposed to what it was in the early days.
Well, it seems like it's talked about openly, but only in, like, train wreck scenarios. So, like, you've got the whole Charlie Sheen thing, and it's like, well, there's a role model I can really get behind.
Yeah,
so.
Exactly. But there is still a stigma, and you're still reluctant to tell people about it in certain arenas. I'm not just saying you, but one is, right?
Right. Absolutely. And to a certain extent, it doesn't matter. There's no reason to tell someone in a professional setting because it's not going to come up. It would be important if I were in, like, some medical field or something like that, that would where it's required to disclose that information. But, you know, for a job interview and that sort of thing, it cannot come up.
Well, what about dating? Has that changed your angle?
So there's certain points in time where, you know, you just get kind of down about it because you're already sampling from a relatively small selection of the population. And then you kind of select down to an even smaller sampling of that already small sampling.
You're talking about the gay community.
Yeah,
right?
So people who are going to be okay with it. But there are, especially, you know, like online where it's just there, it's no consequence type things. And you just, it's like, well, I thought we were having a nice chat, but I guess we weren't having that nice of a chat. Because, you know, the line goes dead. And that sometimes happens when you're talking to somebody in a bar or something. But I guess the idea is you can either not say anything and then kind of let things get to a point where it could be a really big deal and they haven't been told. And then, so you've basically, one way or another, they're going to have to know. So better sooner rather than later, and you don't have to waste your time chasing dead ends.
Yeah, but you know, a few years ago, a lot of us who worked in the AIDS community in the early days of ACT UP and just trying to get people to listen and try to save lives, you know, and the band played on Randy Schiltz's book and all that stuff. It felt like there was a younger generation of men who were becoming quite cavalier about AIDS, and they weren't protecting themselves. They thought, oh, it doesn't matter. They have drugs now. But to tell us what you think about that. I mean, you wouldn't say, don't protect yourself, and, you know, so what if there are drugs? You're still going to have a virus for the rest of your life.
Yeah. No, I wouldn't wish this on anyone. It's not fun. It's not, you know, something to be hoped for. I have spoken with some people where it is a thing, and it's like a fetish, and it becomes very consuming for them, but it's not fun. It certainly isn't like, let's go do that. That sounds like a fun thing to do today.
Because they can give us some drugs and we won't die now.
Right. That said, you know, there are people who do go about having unprotected sex, and there are prophylactic drugs now, which has been, you know, in my time, I've seen, like, I would say that's a pretty big shift in people's attitudes because of the prophylactic drugs. You know, it does make you a little spinny at first, but then you get over it. So it does reduce the transmission rate. And then, you know, having sex with a partner on treatment also really reduces the transmission rate. So you're looking at, I guess you would play a numbers game at that point, but it's very, very minuscule risk of infection at that point. And people have been receptive to it. You know, people that I've dated, I'm like, well, if you want to think about this, there, you should really go talk to your doctor about that. And, you know, some people do and some people don't.
But it's a constant awareness, I would assume, right? I mean, people aren't pretending like it's been cured and we don't have to worry anymore.
I think some people are.
Yeah.
I don't necessarily know that. But again, you know, my sphere of operation is not necessarily all-encompassing.
Yeah. Do you keep up with AMFAR and some, you know, the PAWS magazine? They're talking about new meds that are coming out, and they're talking about trying to find a cure. And,
yeah.
And there's a lot of activism and money.
Yeah, that's a double-edged sword, because you can kind of hope for a cure and hope for a cure and hope for a cure. But, you know, it seems like every time they're like, well, this is really promising. And it's like, well, it's not quite as promising as we thought it was.
Yeah. Well, that's the same way with cancer.
Right. I mean,
these are really intricate, hard things to deal with when you're talking about a whole immune system.
Right. I mean, exactly.
Yeah.
So it's not something, you know, that I necessarily hope for even in my lifetime. So, you know, you just, in what's the sense?
And but you're glad that somebody's working on it, right?
Oh, I mean, certainly.
The fact that money's going into it and
funding's
being raised.
It's been very, you know, I've been very fortunate to be the recipient of such, you know, generosity from very big donors and governmental support and so on. Because otherwise I wouldn't be able to live this kind of, you know, I wouldn't be able to live my life, really.
Yeah. I know it's so different than it was in the early days. There was such hysteria. I mean, I was living in San Francisco in 1982, and fights in the community about whether to close the baths. And, you know, I mean, it was just vicious, some of it.
Yeah. Well, and it's still, I think it's not openly violent, but there still is definitely some people who... Yeah, it doesn't make any sense to me, because if you could just lie to them and be like, well, I'm negative. Oh, well, that's fine then. But you tell them your status and you're honest about it, and then it becomes like this iciness, like, well, judge.
Yeah, yeah. You brought this on yourself.
Right. And I'm like, are you kidding? Like, all I had to do was change one word in that sentence.
Yeah. And, you know, I mean, AIDS is still prevalent in so many African countries, and people are dying because they can't afford the drugs. More and more women are being infected in African countries, and they don't have money for the drugs.
Right.
So, I mean, this is still a killer disease.
It is. It is. It's turning the corner in Africa to a greater or lesser extent. Mm-hmm. And they're really making great progress. So it is, it's wonderful because, you know, you've got an entire continent that was on the verge of
meltdown. Oh, I know it. I know it. Poor
meltdown.
Countries. I know. I wanted to bring this up too, health insurance.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is an expensive disease to maintain. You constantly
absolutely.
You have to have drugs every day. You probably have to have checkups all the time.
So I guess the drugs alone are several $100,000 a year.
Poor person, huh?
Right. I actually had a pharmacist friend of mine explain this to me because the drugs themselves, you know, not particularly expensive to manufacture. I mean, more expensive than many, obviously.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, not several hundred dollars worth of expenses. But because they are being compelled to offer so much free medication to people, for instance, in sub-Saharan Africa, they do raise the prices over here to kind of, you know, balance the books. So in a way, you know, going on medication and that sort of thing is charity, which is just really weird.
Oh, it is.
Yeah. So that doesn't really make a whole lot of sense to me, but I don't necessarily dislike that. It's
mm-hmm.
just... It's definitely a worry because you feel like you're a burden on society.
But did you have a hard time getting health insurance once you were diagnosed? I mean, now that we have a different kind of health system with the Affordable Care Act.
Pre-existing diseases and so on.
Yeah, yeah. But I can imagine a lot of people couldn't even be insured if they were HIV positive.
Oh, probably. I had health insurance through the University of Maryland at the time and then through my employer later in Pittsburgh. And it was, so I didn't really need to worry about it until after the Affordable Care Act, I can't really speak with any degree of certainty about how it would be.
Mm-hmm. But you're being taken care of and you don't have to, that's one aspect that you don't really have to worry about at this point, right?
And being kind of in a certain income bracket, there are social networks, not social networks, but, you know, kind of public funding for people who can't afford the health insurance.
Yeah.
So, because otherwise, there's no way, you know.
God, I'm surprised to hear that it's still that expensive. I swear that the drug companies are screwing us around and ripping us off.
It's the entire medical system because every battery of test is a couple thousand dollars.
Mm-hmm.
So, there's just, it's
are you constantly having to go in for a medical test to test your T cells to make sure things are
every
working
three
correctly?
4 months.
And does the medication have to be adjusted?
No. So the medication is, at least the one that I'm on, is kind of one size fits all, which might be good or bad or otherwise. I don't really know, but I trust that the people who formulated it, you know, did their job.
You know what they were doing, yeah.
My numbers are always good, so, you know, there's a certain degree of don't look a gift horse in the mouth.
But you do, I mean, you do have to have constant vigilance, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you have to go to the doctor, what'd you say, every three or 4 months? And
yeah, and they test and they, you know, poke and prod you for a little bit and how's everything going? Because there's, you know, it is a chronic disease and it does kind of open you up to all sorts of weirdness. Like I get freak bouts of shingles, like,
wow, okay. That's a painful disease sometimes.
Well, but they're like little mini shingles. Like I get them on my scalp sometimes or it's in like
that has to
on
do with HIV,
side.
Not the drugs, right?
Well, so you're in kind of an immunosuppressed state to a greater or lesser extent. It's not the same as if you were like, you know, an organ transplant.
Worried about rejection. Yeah.
Right, yeah. So it's not full on immunosuppression, but it's definitely there. And there are things, you know, like weird dandruff and stuff like that that
uh-huh.
just happens and you're supposed to ask them and they're so used to dealing with people in such a heavily suppressed state that they're like, oh my goodness, this has got to be something, something, something. There was a time when I was like showering with baking soda and I went to the doctor like 4 times because I had this weird rash under my arm that was spreading and it was like, oh my God, no, you've got shingles. No, it's an allergic reaction. No, it's fungus. You know, people in your condition often get fungal infections because fight it off. And then I went to the dermatologist and they're like, so what kind of soap are you using?
Like, so you were allergic?
They literally prescribed me soap. It was just like, no, no, this baking soda thing isn't really going to cut the mustard.
That's really interesting. So the fact is, you probably have to worry about where you're traveling around and where you're going during the day, right? I worked in the schools for a while, and I got sick all the time.
Oh, yeah.
You know? I mean, so do you have to worry about where you go? And
not really. I suppose if I were kind of in more dire straits than I am, then possibly.
Yeah.
But the biggest thing that I found is stress-related illnesses.
Ah.
So, you know, if I get overworked or overtired or, you know, just kind of at my wit's end, that's when I get sick.
Yeah. And all of us, even when our immune systems are normal.
Yeah.
Stress can bring on all kinds of stuff. Yep. Yep.
Yeah.
Well, Scott, we're almost out of time. I wanted to ask you to leave. What would be a message to someone who was just diagnosed with HIV? Well, what would you say to them?
Get your butt into care. Like, that's very important. You know, get on treatment right away. It's not only the responsible thing to do, but it's also the healthy thing to do, because over time, you know, allowing this disease to progress will cause very long-term ramifications like neurological degeneration and that sort of thing. So it's very important to get treated and get followed by a doctor and, you know, just be honest with people because,
Do you think people should get support from, like, AIDS organizations, or if they don't have support from their friends and family?
I think that makes sense for some people and other people it doesn't. I didn't necessarily find it very helpful because, you know, you had a number of people fixating on one thing.
Mm.
And for me, I didn't want to be defined in that particular way. So I didn't find that very helpful because it just seemed like you're fixating on the problem and
and you don't want to
living
just live
your life
in the AIDS community as an AIDS patient, and that's it, right?
Right, and
but you do need emotional support,
right?
When you're diagnosed,
And people are a lot smarter now; they're a lot more aware, to a greater or lesser extent, and it's fine. You know, tell your friends; they're not going to care. So
So seek support and definitely get medical attention immediately.
Right.
Don't wait like Scott did.
Yes, don't wait.
Well, Scott Currie, we're almost out of time. Thank you so much for joining us. I wish you well. Thank you for opening up and talking about this. Again, this is one of my health challenges segments. I've been talking to Scott Currie about his HIV diagnosis and living with this chronic disease. Thank you so much.
Oh, you're very welcome. Thanks for inviting me.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega, and we are a sponsored project of the New York Foundation for the Arts. Tax-deductible donations are welcome at artspire.org. That's artspire.org. And visit us online at outoboundsradioshow.com. I'm Tish Perlman. We'll be back next week.